Hello and welcome to this episode of the Global Innovators in Business series. In this series, we bring leaders and innovators from different fields to share their advice and experiences with undergraduate students to provide inspiration and motivation during the pandemic. We're so happy to have with us Annie Duke. Annie is an author and a world-renowned expert in the decision-making space. She has written two amazing books, Thinking in Bets and most recently, How to Decide. She's a former professional poker player, winning a World Series of Poker bracelets and numerous other major tournaments. This full interview is dedicated to Alliance for Decision Education, an organization that Annie Duke co-founded with a mission to improve lives by empowering students through decision skills education. They have worked with education experts in creating engaging and award-winning programs that introduce decision-making skills to students. They're continuing to push this education through a national movement. So thank you so much, Annie, to join this interview.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So I know you co-founded the Alliance for Decision Education nonprofit. What is it about and why did you start it?
Yes. Basically, when we're thinking about decision making, mm-hmm. you know, what we realized was that there's a lot of work that's been done studying decision making in adults, both where it goes wrong and how you can possibly make it better, really starting with this huge movement with Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky and Richard Thaler, Barry Staub, where people started realizing there are a whole bunch of errors in human judgment, that we aren't perfectly rational, even if we have the perfect information, we aren't perfectly rational. And so starting in the 70s, there was this big movement to study where decision-making goes wrong. And then recently, of course, this is a big part of the popular literature, right? With things like Thinking Fast and Slow, for example. But what we saw was that same velocity that was happening behind understanding decision-making in adults and how you can make it better wasn't being pushed down into K through 12 education. And when you look at K through 12 education, it looks the same as it did 100 years ago. So we were asking ourselves, simply put, like, why are we teaching trigonometry, but not like judgment and decision making? Because if you think about it, like for any human life, it's just the sum of luck, which you don't have any control over. Like, when were you born? Who were you born to? What are your capabilities? Those kinds of things. And the quality of your decisions. And as I said, luck you can't control, but the quality of your decisions you can. So this seems to be something that we might want to be laser focused on in really improving individual lives and the outcomes of an individual's life, but also in improving society, which I think we're feeling really keenly now in terms of the information ecosystem that we're living in and how hard it is for people to figure out what's true, how hard it is for people to figure out what to do given what they know. And we just think this is like really kind of emergency level. So we founded the Alliance to start to bring decision education into K through 12 education. It's a big task. It's a lofty goal. We think it's going to take a long time, but we think the payoff is so huge that mm-hmm. it's definitely worth it to put the effort in.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Throughout my high school education in the United States, there was never a class that talked about how we can decide our future and decide our careers and all these important aspects of our life. So that will be very important. And also, Alliance for Decision Education has a podcast, so you can also check that out. They also have a pledge to go over and then sign that through the link in the description.
The podcast has some really amazing people on it. I think mm-hmm. the opening episode was Michael Mobison, who mm-hmm. has done really amazing work in business and decision making and really cognitive science. He has an incredible book that I really recommend called The Success Equation, mm-hmm. which is about the influence of luck and skill in your life. Uses a lot of sports analogies for people who are interested in sports. But he's such an incredible writer. He's on our advisory board. Daniel Kahneman's on our advisory board. Phil Tetlock from Penn is on our advisory board. It's a lot of great people who are really behind the cause, who really see this as something that's really important to be spending their time on.
So the first question is actually, while in college, how did you decide what you want to do in your career?
Yes, I think maybe part of the reason why I'm so interested in decision-making is because I feel like a lot of the decisions that I made early on in the life, I wouldn't really call decisions. Like, I'd say that I was either really influenced by what I thought the values of my parents were, mm-hmm. you know, what I thought I was supposed to value, the kinds of things that I was supposed to do. My father was an English teacher in a high school, and really valued like the humanities and that side of the equation. So I think it was just obviously I was going to, one of my majors was going to be English Lit, just because I was trying to live my father's values. I was actually really, I did a lot of math in high school, but when I got to college, I lived at a time when women weren't in those kinds of fields so much and not necessarily really encouraged into them. And for a variety of reasons, just culturally, it was like women don't do math. So I found my way into something that was a little bit more mathematical through psychology. And that's how I think how I ended up there, because it was a way for me to merge like the softer side of things with the more sciencey side that I really loved. And so that's how I ended up on my double major. I think that if I had it to go back and do again, and I really thought through what was going to be really exciting for me and fit in with what my talents were, I likely would have pursued something more directly math-like and maybe done that plus psychology as opposed to have the English major. But not that I'm not happy for the English major. I came out of it well-read and able to write, which obviously ended up helping later in life as I started to write books. But then where I think my decision-making really fell apart was in terms of what I was going to do after college. So I had been worked with a woman named Barbara Landau, who was a professor at Columbia, and I was her research assistant for the whole 4 years that I was there. And she was, I thought, I really love psychology and I love working with her. And so I want to keep doing this. I applied to Columbia Graduate School, but she encouraged me to apply Penn because her mentors, Lila and Henry Gleitman, were at Penn, and she thought it'd be great if I went off and worked with them. And again, in that like people pleasing mode, not that it wasn't pleasing myself, it's just that I don't think I stepped back and said, what are my options? Should I take time off? Should I think about other things that I might want to do? Do I want to explore things that are not psychology or whatever? I was just like, sounds good. Like I'm already on this path. I'll just go on that path. So I ended up at Penn Graduate School for 5 years. And it's interesting. It wasn't until the very end when I had been struggling with a stomach illness that landed me in the hospital and was actually forced to take a year off that I started exploring other options. And that's actually when I found poker. And I think that was such a huge lesson for me in that moment, that it took something very external forcing me to take time off to actually see it as like actively choosing what I wanted to do at that time. And then I took that lesson going forward. And I think that's part of the reason that, and also just really facing down this big decision-making problem that poker's presenting, that got me to be super obsessed with that topic. I had studied it some when I was in graduate school, but I was more focused on language acquisition when I was in graduate school, although that obviously has to do with learning. But then judgment and decision-making became like my real passion that I feel like merged everything, right? Like statistics and probability, which is really mathematical. And then the psychological side of what I was doing, the kind of practical real world investing, high stakes decision-making that I was doing at poker. And then eventually I start writing about it, which I guess pulls in that English major. So it all ended up working out, but I feel like I didn't start viewing things as an active decision until later on.
I guess the question I have is, do you think there is any merit to going with the flow and not thinking about these decisions as much?
So the answer is no, because I think that going with the flow can be a totally active decision, right? Going with the flow, I think, is fine when there's no impact to it. If increasing the chance that you're not getting the best match for who you are or what you want to do is not a big deal, then sure, go with the flow. That's the same as saying, just go with your gut or whatever. But it's not that I couldn't have ended up. I may still have ended up having stepped back and really thought about it as a double major in English and psychology. I may have still ended up at Penn. All of those things might have still been true, but I would have explored the other options that were available to me as well before I was forced to. I don't think that there is an advantage to do that unless the downside isn't very great, at which point I would highly encourage you to go with the flow, because I don't think you should waste a lot of time on stuff that doesn't have a very big downside.
Yes. Yeah, I completely agree. I just think your career has been so interesting, so fascinating, but those are also in some ways active decisions in its own way.
Well, yeah, I mean, once I stopped, obviously it was an active decision for me to play poker. And then somebody asked me to give a talk on how poker might inform decision-making. And I actively chose to go give that talk. And then I actively chose to start growing that side of my life because it was something that really interested me. And then I started doing those things in parallel. And then I wanted to write books and I thought about that. And then now I'm back doing research at Penn in Phil Tetlock and Bart Meller's lab. And so notice that it's my path is still, even from that moment when I'm forced to take time off from graduate school, my path is still very windy, right? It's still like I was doing poker and then I was doing corporate speaking and then I started doing consulting and then I started writing and then I went back to research and then it still ends up being very windy. It's just that I was much more intentional about that. So I'm a really big believer in explore lots of different things, figure out what you can do in parallel. Don't get too wedded to one thing you're doing. Like I quit playing poker. This was obviously a very big part of my identity. Now I would identify myself much more as an author and academic. I do business consulting, but I was always saying, let me see what options are available and let me see how I can sample the world a lot. And I think that being more intentional about that has actually created more sampling because when I wasn't thinking so much about it, it was like, I'm doing psychology and then I'm going to go to graduate school and then I'm going to be a professor. And once I have that moment where I'm forced to quit, that's when I go off and play poker. And then I start taking this sort of very exploratory, let me try options. Let me never get too stuck in any one thing I'm doing. And that's not to say that I'm not gritty, right? I persevered in poker. I still want to excel at the things that I'm trying. Mm-hmm. It's just that I'm doing a lot of sampling and I'm trying to always figure out this thing, like just because I'm doing it or just because I'm good at it doesn't mean necessarily that I shouldn't switch. It doesn't mean necessarily that I shouldn't figure out how to do two things at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I was playing poker and doing the business consulting at the same time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say I got more exploratory as I got more intentional.
I know in your book, you talk about decision stacking. And one of the really good ways to find your future larger decisions is to make smaller decisions that have a quicker feedback loop and you can better understand what's happening. So I guess after going through that process, what is your advice? What is your top three advice for students who are seeking to figure out what to decide for their careers?
So number one is always reserve the option to quit, to abandon what you're doing. So I think one of the problems we have, and this was certainly true for me, is that once we start down a course, it starts to become kind of part of our identity. We internalize it as who we are. And if we abandon that course, what does that mean? Does it mean we failed? And I think it can be really hard. So like I say, like I got sick. That's why I had to stop graduate school at the end of 5 years. There's no way I would have done that otherwise because it would be too hard. Like, why did I put the 5 years in and this is who I am and I was supposed to be a professor and now have I failed? So thinking about that kind of thing in advance, I think it's really important, and particularly, obviously, the younger you are, the easier this is to do, that view the first part of your sort of career life as going into it, like, I'm going to sample this. I'm going to see how I like it. And I'm going to try a few different things at once. And I'm going to move around quite a bit until I find the thing that really, like, I can't let go of, that's so interesting to me that I really want to go deep. So I think that's number one is just you start. Don't get into that situation where like your first job, you get into it and you start it and then you just don't give up that career because you feel like it would make you that first choice a mistake. It's absolutely not. Number two, even after you do find the thing that like really sparks your passion that you really want to go deep on, still have those exploratory lines going, right? It doesn't mean that you have to commit to any of those things, but those things may eventually bear fruit. And that's true whether you're talking about dating or like your career advice, right? Or even when you're taking classes, as much as you can, take classes outside of your major, start sampling other things that might be of interest to you. So I think that's also incredibly important. Mm-hmm. Make sure that even after you pick that you're sampling. So that would be my second piece of advice. Mm-hmm. And my third piece of advice that I think is really, really important is find those people in your life who really want the best for you, but you're giving them permission to not worry about hurting your feelings. And the reason for that is that I think, and we can all feel this when we watch our friends, is that we don't always see ourselves that clearly, right? When your friends are doing something stupid or picking like a job or staying in a class or staying in a major or whatever, that you can just tell, what are you doing? You should stop. We can see that really clearly in other people, but we can't necessarily see that in ourselves really well. So I think it's really important to find those really great outside advisors and say to them, don't worry about hurting my feelings. Like, you're here to give me the truth. And your expression of how much you love me is to really advise me in a way where you're not concerned about, is this going to hurt my feelings? Because I want to know what the right thing to do is. And I've been really lucky to have a lot of different people like that in my life. Mm-hmm. And if you can start to develop those kind of outside advisors who are more objective that you can go to for advice earlier on in life, you're going to be a lot better off.
Yeah, I love that advice. So number one is be able to quit after you make the decision. Secondly, be able to keep it as more exploratory and also keep other options open, and also have a group of people around you that can provide you genuine direct feedback. So I guess in the very beginning, as I just graduated and I'm thinking of two options, very good options, I don't know what to choose. What are some of the factors that I should potentially think about as I make that decision?
Oh gosh, when you say I have two really good options and I can't decide which to choose, mostly I would tell you to pull a coin out and flip. Okay, so let me explain what I mean by that. Generally, when we think that decisions are really hard, it can be actually a sign that they're quite easy under specific circumstances. So when you have two options that are really good, these are the types of things where we can get really sunk into these analysis loops where we keep asking for more information. We keep going to those outside advisors and asking for more advice, or we're going like on review sites or just trying to figure out between these two options that feel really good to us, what's the difference between the two? Because we feel like we sort of sense that they're, if we were omniscient and we had the time machine, there'd be an objectively correct answer.
Yes.
But the problem is we're not omniscient and we don't have a time machine. So even though we can feel like, if I just tried a little harder, I could get to that objectively correct answer. Mm-hmm. You can't. And so you have to think about, in the same way that we think about visual acuity, like how well do we see with our eyes? We want to think about cognitive acuity. How well can we see with our minds? And can you actually, if you have two really good job offers that you're choosing between, given the state of knowledge that you have, which is very little when you think about it, right? Like you haven't been in that job. You might be in that job for 3 years and you don't even know what you're going to be like in 3 years, right? So that makes it even harder. You're just as much as those people might be interviewing you, you're interviewing that job, but that's really limited information. Mm-hmm. Right? There's a lot of guessing going on in there. Educated guessing for sure, but guessing. So once we recognize that, what we realize is given the knowledge that we have, we probably aren't going to be able to distinguish between those two great options anyway. So stop trying. Once you get to the point where if you imagine what I call the only option test, which is if this were the only option that I had available to me, if you're choosing between two jobs, is this the only job that would I be like going and bragging to everybody about it and really excited? The answer here would be yes. And then if I look at the other option, I say, if this were the only one, would I be going around like chest puffed up? I'm so excited that I got this job offer. If the answer to both of those is yes, that means they're both great options. And you probably shouldn't be fooling yourself into thinking that you can distinguish between the two of them. That's why I say flip a coin. But what that brings us to is like, how do we actually get to options that satisfy this only option test? And that's a thresholding problem. So we want to divide our decision-making into sorting versus picking. So picking is, I've got two really great options. They both satisfy the only option test. Now you're in the picking process, flip a coin. Sorting is getting things above a certain threshold. And that has to do with you stepping back and saying, what are the things that I believe I value? And that's going to have to do with you personally. And given what I value and what I want out of the job, what are the questions that I can ask? Where's the information that's going to come? Where's that going to come from? That's going to help me figure out if this fits in with the things that I want, given the constraints that I might have. Mm-hmm. Constraints, right? I want to be a CEO. You just graduated from college. So there's going to be a constraint in terms of what level you're going to enter a company at. And so within those constraints of where I'm going to level, that's going to be true of salary as well, right? There's only so much money that you're going to be offered when you're starting out. And just think about what those constraints are. And then within those constraints, how much is this fitting in with the things that I want from a job? And you have to actually be intentional and write down, what are the things that I believe that I want? And then take whatever opportunities you have available to you and actually create a rubric for yourself and rate those things. On the scale of 0 to 5, you can do some forecasts. What's the likelihood I think that I'm going to be really happy in this job in a year? And really do that intentionally before you start on the job process. And now what you can do, the point is when you get to two ones that you really like, it means they scored really high on this rubric. So they passed whatever that threshold was. And then don't bother yourself about it. So put your energy into sort of creating that rubric and figuring out something that allows you to express the things that you're hoping for. And then once you've done that and you've got things that score really high, then don't do much work after that because you're not going to know. You're not going to be able to figure it out.
I see. In short, to gather as much information as you can to build a system evaluating the decision to the best of your knowledge, then once you get to a point where there's a few good options and there's not that much more information to get and understanding, then just flip a coin and see how it goes.
Yeah. So I would just amend and say, gather enough and appropriate information to get something across the threshold.
I see.
Because I don't want people to think that just because the information, like you shouldn't spend all your time trying to gather information if it's not actually going to change anything. Like once something's above the threshold, you should stop that. Mm-hmm. And then you can always ask yourself a final question. Okay. I flipped the coin. I decided on job A. Is there something I could find out that would change my mind? Mm-hmm. And the answer to that is almost always no, but occasionally it's yes, I could go ask somebody something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so we really, the way that I talk about is think about ordering off a menu, right? Like when you approach a menu in a restaurant, it's here's all the stuff I don't like.
Yes.
I don't like eggplant. Okay, so that's off my list. I'm a vegan. So anything that has meat in it or dairy is off my list. So I just sort out the things that I don't like and then everything else is met a threshold. Mm-hmm. And so I shouldn't spend a lot of time trying to decide between the stuff that's mm-hmm. met my threshold. And we should be approaching more decisions like that.
Got it. Yeah, I'll definitely try that. So next time I go to a restaurant. The other part of this is after we make a decision, how do we cope with a decision that we might not have liked? Should we feel regretful?
Yeah, so this problem of regret. So we need to redefine what it means to make a mistake. Here's the thing. And this actually plays into a little bit of that desire to keep getting more information. So if we think that getting a bad outcome is a mistake, then we're going to get really defensive about the decision in the first place. So it's going to be hard for us to decide when we're like 70% sure, and we're going to be pushing toward trying to get to absolute certainty, which is like really going to slow us down. It's going to cause a lot of anxiety, and it's an illusion anyway. You're not going to get to absolute certainty regardless. And even if you could, you can't defend against bad outcomes because there's luck, mm-hmm. right? So that would maybe solve for some of the informational problem. But by the way, still sometimes just bad luck happens.
Yes.
So in the same sense that I can go through a green light and I can get in an accident. I didn't, mm-hmm. I did the right thing. I had the information that green means go. Mm-hmm. I was going the speed limit, all those things. And yet still a bad thing can happen to me. And that does not make it a mistake to go through green lights. Mm-hmm. Now with that, it's much clearer because we really understand green means go. Mm-hmm. But for most things, like we don't have that green means go to fall back on that sort of allows us to separate out the outcome from the quality of the decision. Mm-hmm. Like when you're thinking about what job should I take, what are the rules? This is like personal to you. And you have much less information than when you're going through a traffic light, right? Like mm-hmm. you're new, you haven't been in that position before. They haven't had you in that position. You're trying it out for the first time. You're not even 100% sure, and you can't be that this is the career path that you want to take, so on and so forth. That's actually a really complex decision with very little information. So mm-hmm. you try to do the best process you can, but understand in advance, it might not work out.
I see.
And the thing that you don't want to get into the habit of is automatically coding that as a mistake. In the same way, I was trying to decide between two dishes on a restaurant menu, like the chicken or the fish, and I got the chicken. And then I'm like, oh, that was a mistake. What are mm-hmm. you talking about? How could that be a mistake? There were two things that you liked just fine, and you hadn't tasted the dish yet. Mm-hmm. You couldn't know until it came to you that you weren't going to like it, mm-hmm. right? But we automatically say those things are mistakes, and that really hangs us up. So a better use of your time is to say, okay, I'm trying to decide between these two jobs. I've decided I'm going to take A, maybe because I flipped a coin, maybe because it was the thing that actually crossed the threshold and other opportunities didn't. For whatever reason, I'm taking this job. Now imagine it's a year from now and I'm not happy in the job. Mm-hmm. And really write those reasons down. Why would I not be happy? And then in advance, think about what you're going to do about it. So there's some problems where you can say really early on, I'm going to look for those signs and I'm going to get really proactive and I'm going to talk to my supervisor or I'm going to talk to my coworkers or whatever. There's other things where you can say this would be a deal breaker if I find out that this thing is true of the position that I'm in or that this thing is true of myself. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes you think you're going to really like a position and it turns out that you don't mm-hmm. or that your tastes change. If those things are, is that a deal breaker and you're going to quit as fast as possible? How are you going to think about how to preserve your options? right? So what are the connections that you can be keeping up at the same time that make it so that you have other places to jump to that are a little bit easier? And that doesn't mean that you aren't committed to the job that you're in, because when you're keeping those other connections open, they may help you actually perform better in the job that you're in, as well as serving the purposes of possibly being a place that you could jump to. So you could think about those kinds of plans in advance as well. But that way you've already, you know, the way that I put it is you've metabolized, you've incorporated the bad outcome already. It's something that you've foreseen. And then instead of being really reactive and getting emotional about it, you're like, oh yeah, no, I already thought that about this possibility. I knew when I took the job, I might not like it. And I already have thought about what I'm going to do about it.
I see. So trying to redefine mistake as based off of decision processes instead of the actual outcome of the results.
Yeah, like here's a mistake. I went on one job interview and they offered me the job and I took it. That's probably a mistake, right? You probably should have checked out a few other jobs, a few other listings. You should have applied to more than one place, right? Maybe it's not a mistake, but maybe before you even applied, you knew that was your number one choice. I would still argue that you should probably see if you can get some other interviews just so you can do some comparison, right? Yeah. Maybe that's a mistake, but that's a process error. And I would like to point out that job might work out great and it's still a mistake. So the reverse applies as well, which is one thing that we lose sight of, right? I can have a really bad outcome and it cannot be a mistake. It might be a mistake, but it could not be a mistake. But I can also have a great outcome and it could be a mistake, right? So I would argue that, as I said, like my decision process about what my majors were going to be in college and whether I went to graduate school, I don't think I had a good process there. Now, they actually worked out quite well. But I would say that if I had it to do over again, I would change the decision process because I would have a process, which I'm not sure that I did. So I think that we need to realize that as well, right? So that we want to think about mistakes more in the sense of there was information I could have gotten. There were other options that I could have explored. I went with my gut for a really important decision. I didn't really make explicit what my values were, what I thought the state of the world was that was going to make this a good match for me and those kinds of things. Yeah, then you could, I still hesitate to use the word mistake, but if you were going to use it, it would apply more to that part.
I see. Got it. And this goes back to a very fundamental idea in poker where you don't really know other people's hands and there's so much variability. So how do we try to understand what is variable, what is not?
Oh, yeah. So this is really the skill versus luck problem. So think about luck as anything outside of your influence. Very often, like the actions of other people would go into that category, just random stuff like the weather that would go into that category. If you went through an intersection and someone didn't follow the traffic laws and you got in an accident with them, that goes into luck. So in poker, luck is mostly in the form of the cards that are yet to come. And the cards that you get dealt in the first place and the way those match up. Maybe the only way you can win is to hit the queen of clubs, and that's going to happen 2% of the time. But it will happen 2% of the time, and I don't have any control over when it happens and when it doesn't. Likewise, maybe that's the only way I can win is to hit the two of clubs, the queen of clubs, and that will also happen 2% of the time. So if I hit the queen of clubs and win, I better not be patting myself on the back too hard because I was probably in a pretty bad situation. But like you can think about, for example, like the pandemic is, it's obviously a matter of luck. Like you have no control over a pandemic all of a sudden popping up. And then there's a whole bunch of disruption in the job market that you didn't have a lot of control over. So we want to recognize the luck and be able to see it, but we also don't want to get too caught up in it because we can't control it. And it's not really useful to bemoan the state of the job market now. Like that doesn't really help you to get to a better outcome. It might offload some emotion temporarily, right? And sometimes that's useful to just say to someone who loves you, I just want to complain for a second. And I'm not saying that doesn't have use. I've done that before, but you don't want to really get buried in that, right? Because you don't control it. What you do control is the quality of your decisions. And the part of the quality of your decisions that you really control is, first of all, understanding what a decision is and how to construct one, which is it's every decision that you make is a prediction. And I'm willing to make that bold statement because I'm quite sure that's true. If something really simple, what I'm going to order off a restaurant menu, I'm making a prediction that I'm going to like the thing I eat. Or maybe I'm choosing for healthiness. I'm making the prediction that as I think about the intersection between healthy and yummy, that this will satisfy that intersection the best of anything, as an example. What route should I take to work? I'm making a prediction about how long it's going to take me to work, get to work, given the route that I'm choosing, which means I'm making predictions about traffic. And then I have to make a prediction about what time I have to get up in the morning. And obviously you can imagine, like, when you're choosing a job, that's clearly a prediction about what's going to get you what you want in the future. So that's the first thing, is we have to recognize that decisions are predictions and we need to treat them as such, which means we need to think about, what do we believe is true of the world? What are the things that we believe will be true of the world? We need to make some forecasts about that. How likely do I think those things are going to be true? We need to think about our own preferences and the things that we think we're going to dislike. All of those things have to go in. So that's the structure of the decision itself. And then the big thing, though, is that we have a lot of control over the quality of the information that goes into our decision. So in poker, it's true that I can't see my opponent's cards. That is totally a true thing. But as I get to be more expert, my ability to narrow down and figure out better what that opponent holds is because I become better at two things. One is noticing the information that's being offered to me about the way that my opponent is acting, understanding how hands tend to relate to boards and things like that's helping me make that prediction about what I think that they hold. But the other thing is that my betting becomes better in a way that I can ask my opponents about what their cards are. And I become much more expert at asking the right questions and knowing what questions are going to get me to the highest value in terms of the information that I might get. A simple example would be, if I'm the one doing the hiring and I'm trying to think about how can I really improve the information I can get about this candidate, I could, instead of calling the references that they offer, which I would do out of a courtesy, I could start thinking about the network of people that person may have interacted with, figure out what the intersection is, and call some people who aren't on their list. That's going to be really high value information for me, right? There, we know that the people that are on the list are likely to offer positive references. Yeah. If I can get to their network of people, I'm not looking for a negative reference. I'm just looking for some people that they didn't themselves give me the phone numbers of, right? So that's a way for me to think about, in a very intentional way, how could I improve the quality of the information that I have. Here's a really simple example that's been put into technology. So it used to be that if I was trying to choose a route somewhere, I had to look at a map and then probably talk to other people and try to figure out things about traffic patterns and whatnot out of my own experience and talking to other people and so on and so forth. Now I have a GPS. So what is the GPS doing for me? It's actually improving the quality of the information that's getting input into the decision that I'm making about when I should leave and what route I should take. But that's what we want to start thinking like when we're making our own decisions. And we have so much control over that part of the equation.
And first of all, that's a little bit daunting that employers could be calling people who didn't put a reference list.
Employers do. So just so you know, by the way, just so you know, maybe not for an entry level position, but at some point during your career, people are going to reference specifically people who you don't send them. So I will let you know that this is very common practice among employers. It's quite smart of them to do. And I would also suggest that you do the same from the other end of the equation. So a lot of times when you say, oh, I'd really love to talk to some people who work here, they'll offer you their happiest employees. That you should be thinking about, is there anybody I know, or could I find out someone who, for example, left this position?
That's so
interesting. I'd really like to understand why. And know that when you talk to them, they may have quite a negative frame and you want to take that into account, but you want to figure out if the reasons that they left are things that would be deal breakers for you, right? So you should also be referencing that job and you should do the same thing.
I see.
So this is a two-way street and it works for both of you.
That's a really good advice. And also I think another way to just gain more information before you step into that decision is to do an internship or to have some kind of experience in that job.
Yeah. So that's the sampling problem, right? So wonderful way to get information. I love that you brought that up. Do things that are lower risk, that are lower impact. If you don't like an internship, obviously that's a lot less impactful for you because there's a beginning and an end of the sampling period. Then if you go in and you go and actually commit to a contract that you're going to have to break, or then it becomes like a whole thing, right? Not only are internships an amazing way to sample jobs, but It's also really helpful if you don't do the same internship every single year, right? That you actually try to think about what are the other things I might be interested in? Let me go try that. And one of the ways to think about this, actually, I'll use college classes as an example, is I think I said, like, when you're trying to decide your freshman year classes, you could actually pick classes that satisfy the most majors possible. Like, that's actually a really good strategy, is I'm going to get classes that are going to fill the most requirements possible so that I have the most majors open to me. So I'm widening as opposed to narrowing my scope. You can think about that with internships as well. If I take this internship, how many different types of jobs would this be really good on my resume for?
I see.
And the maximum number of opportunities that this would be a good internship for, you should prefer those types of internships and do a lot of those.
Got
because
it.
That's going to give you the biggest sample and it's going to keep the most options open available to you post-internship as you're trying to figure out what job you want to take.
Got it. Yeah. Thank you so much. That sounds great. And that's such good advice. In your podcast with Peter Atiyah, you mentioned that if something doesn't work out, you should quit fast. But how do you know when to quit and when to grit it out?
Yeah, that's such a great question. Thank you so much for that. It's interesting. The scientific literature is actually quite strong on the idea that we don't quit enough. There are certainly obvious cases where we don't persevere. I think they tend to be, first of all, when you're younger, right? There's a big high school dropout problem. And I think that can be really difficult, particularly as you enter ninth grade with some math that you might not have encountered before that can cause people to give up. It's also true, like we can see where perseverance is really important with things like sticking to, for example, quitting alcohol or drugs or sticking to an exercise regimen or things like that, that are difficult. They run against our biology. But when we look at this, once we committed to a course of action and we started to put resources in it, whether it's like our time, but a lot of times it's our identity, right? I'm a chemistry major. How do you switch from that? Like you're saying, I'm this thing.
Yes.
And that becomes really hard. That the literature is quite clear that even when we get negative signals, like you're going up Everest and the weather's getting bad and you should really turn around and someone from the outside can see that, we tend to persist. And we tend to, in the face of information coming our way, we'll tend to keep going. And we can't, this is the key, we can't rely on ourselves in the moment to make good decisions about it. Because we'll rationalize it. So there's actually something called summit fever, which is like when you're really close to the summit, when you're close to the goal, that's this big danger zone, because you'll start to rationalize, no, I'll be able to push through the weather. Or yeah, I know it's like an hour and a half after turnaround time, which is when I should have turned around because it would be too dangerous, but I can just tough it out. And you'll come up with all these reasons to keep going. Same thing, like I'm a chemistry major and maybe I'm unhappy, but I'm so close. And if I just do these extra classes and then I'll be done. And then when now all of a sudden, then it's, you can't give that up. You have to go into that as a career because otherwise, why would you have spent all that time in the major? And you can see how this can really escalate.
Yes.
So there's three ways that you can help yourself out of this problem. Way number one is when you enter into the course, like if you're entering into a job, identify the signals that would tell you would want to quit in advance and what kind of signals you might misinterpret that you would make you want to stick. Right. So for example, if I'm going into high school and algebra is really hard in ninth grade, that's not a reason to quit. Right. So you can think about that in advance. So what are the things that you can just write down a list? Here are the things that I imagine might be really hard as I enter into this that might make me think I want to quit when actually I should stay. Right. Like I have a bothersome coworker, assuming they're not bothersome in the really horrible ways that a coworker can be bothersome or something like that. Or the job is a lot of errand running. Maybe you shouldn't quit because you should be thinking instead about what's the next job that I would be promoted to, because sometimes that's what first jobs are. So you could figure out what are those things where I'm going to probably read it wrong. And then also what are the things that really are deal breakers, right? The people who are my immediate superiors, which is the place where I would get promoted to next. I don't like them. The culture of this workplace is really toxic, where you really shouldn't be toughing it out, right? Or I've discovered I hate chemistry. So write those things down in advance. Think about what those signals are that could be occurring that would cause you to quit. Another way that you can do it is sometimes you can just set a clock to it. Here would be an example. You get a PhD in English literature. There's a limited number of tenure track positions that are available. That number doesn't change very much. So you can actually just say, I'm going to give it 4 years. And then on that date, I'm going to go and do something else. That would apply also for if you're thinking, I want to be an Olympic sprinter, you know that you need to hit certain time marks by certain ages, or you're probably not going to be able to do it. And if you don't hit that, you should then probably go and spend your time doing something else or run for fun or something, but you should change your goal. So think about how you can think about those things in advance that are going to be the good quitting signals. So that's number one. Number two is really focus on decision quality, like process as opposed to outcome. So pay less attention to when outcomes are bad. Now, why would you say that? Why shouldn't you pay attention to a bad outcome? Won't that make you quit? This is where the things get really weird. That is actually what makes you escalate your commitment. So it turns out that when we get bad signals, we'll tend to double down and we'll keep going in order to try to save the day or save our identity. Start getting focused on making good choices by process and stop viewing outcomes, bad outcomes, as mistakes, because that's actually part of the problem that gets us to not quit enough. I know that's counterintuitive, but that it's very well documented in the science. And then the third thing is basically what I said to you, find someone who really loves you, but isn't worried about hurting your feelings. Right? Like that's something that Daniel Kahneman told me that I really carried with me is that if you can find that person, they're going to help you figure out when you should switch and it's going to be so much better for you.
I see. On the idea of signals, and there's two small points. During the summer, I tried to try out TikTok and I made a goal of within 2 weeks, if I could get a certain number of followers, I would continue creating content on TikTok. And if I couldn't, I would stop. And It was a disaster, but I realized that was a good quitting point. And I created a signal that allowed me to do that.
Right. And you can see if you don't set that up in advance, it's 2 weeks in, you're like, but no, I have another idea. I could just create this kind of content, or I added 20 more followers in the last whatever. And I think maybe I'm getting some velocity behind it or whatever. You can see how you can start to rationalize that to where all of a sudden you're a year in and you've tried 17 different ways to create content and none of them are working. You've spent all this time trying to do it. Because you didn't in advance think about what are the benchmarks, like what kind of thresholds do I need to meet? And if I don't meet those, I'm just going to be done and I'm going to go spend my time doing something else, which would be more fruitful. So we really want to be careful about continuing to throw resources after losing courses of action. And this is a thing that we really do a lot. And I bet for everybody who's listening, they can think about friends who've been stuck in really bad majors or started in really bad jobs. Or how about this? Relationships, right? Where everybody can see that you should be breaking up with that person.
Yes.
And like it's just excuse after excuse. No, but they were really nice to me yesterday or whatever. And you can see it. And then it goes on forever. And then what happens every single time? Finally, they break up with them. And what do they always say? I should have done that so much sooner. Same thing with, I was in a crappy job. The culture was horrible of the job. It was toxic. It wasn't even something that I was passionate about, but I stuck with it because I didn't want to say, why did I take the job in the first place? Or why did I start down this course? Or all those things that we have that self-talk with. And then when you do finally quit, what do you always say? I should have quit 6 months earlier. So we want to be the 6 months earlier.
Yes.
That's what we're trying to get to, is that earlier quitting. So the TikTok example is a really good example.
Yeah. And then most recently, I was reading a book by Tony Hsieh. He talked about when he was starting his first company called Link Exchange. At the end of it, he realized that, like his previous job that he really didn't like, he kept pressing the snooze button time after time before he went to work. And that was his signal that he should leave this role. So those are just some examples. There are so many ways that you can mentally see what was the best signal for you.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the next question is, in poker, there's this term called all in. So when will you go all in life?
Oh, huh. That's a really good question. The obvious example is depending on what your preferences are. You'll go all in some way generally when you get married. And I think that's even if you're not monogamous, because generally there's still rules around that and some limited set of people. So you're cutting off a certain amount of exploration at that point. But certainly if you're entering into something that's a single partner, that would be a case of all in, where you're just saying, this is it, I'm exercising this option and I'm done, which I think is a little bit what all in is. The thing that I would say is that this construct in poker of all in, that's the end of your chips. I want to be clear that it's a bad analogy. You should be trying to avoid that situation. And in poker, you're really not in that situation. So let me explain what I mean. Part of what managing your bankroll well in poker is making sure that if you go all in and you lose that hand, that you can come back and enter another game. So you're actually specifically, we want to separate like going all in on a particular hand where it might be correct because you think that you have the best hand or this is your best way to bluff somebody. Yes. And those types of situations would come up in like negotiations where you're willing to break a deal.
Yes.
But hopefully that deal isn't, if you don't get that deal, that's the end of you.
Mm-hmm.
Because in poker, you don't ever want to be in a situation where it's literally the end of you. So I wouldn't enter a tournament with my last dollar.
Mm-hmm.
So that any time that I went all in during that tournament, if I got knocked out of the tournament, I couldn't enter a new tournament. I wouldn't enter a cash game with my last dollar. So you're actually trying to make sure that you can come back and play again. So we want to think about the difference between all in life, where if you lose, it's actually an existential threat. Really good to avoid those situations. But you can think very clearly about how to imagine using this kind of all-in play, like in a negotiation, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that actually plays to the idea of not being all-in. If I have lots of options available to me, I can negotiate as hard as I want on a single option because I have other options I can go and do. Yes. It actually puts me into a much better place in terms of the ability to go all-in on the things that I want mm-hmm. and say my way or the highway. These are the things I want. These are the things that I choose to have for myself. And if you don't take it, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Because I actually have preserved other options available to me. And that's what you're doing in poker, is managing that ability. And the other thing is, what's really nice is that actually circles back, because part of being a great poker player is that you have to have the option to go all in sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And you won't use that option if it's your last dollar.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll actually prevent you from playing well. That's a lot of why we don't really want to be doing that. But I would definitely say, if you're entering into a single partner relationship, that would be a version of all in.
Got it. Yes. And then the last question is, going into the future, especially with uncertain aspects like the pandemic, what is your last source for students to navigate the situation and find their path forward?
Yeah. First of all, I think get ready for the roaring 20s. There's a lot of pent up consumer demand.
Mm-hmm.
I know, because I had a son who graduated this year. It's been really sucky for him graduating into the pandemic. I can't even imagine. I know you're in that situation as well. And it's been quite mm-hmm. difficult for him. Whereas people who are graduating in 2 years, it's going to be a really different story, assuming that we get the pandemic under control. Let's hope that's the case.
Yes.
Because there is so much pent up consumer demand. And one assumes that you're going to, after these kinds of situations, you tend to see economies explode, like yes. explode in the good sense of the world, not the bad sense of the word. But I think that in terms of advice, I would say just realize the situation right now is temporary mm-hmm. and there is opportunity to be had in it. Sometimes it's not bad to have the path that you thought you were supposed to go on disrupted. Mm-hmm. And obviously it can be really bad. I just want to be clear about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that I think that we need to be careful about feeling like we're not doing a service to the severity of the suffering that's come from the pandemic by also seeing silver linings. And I think that both of those things can exist at the same time. And I think this has been a place where people can really explore what they like and what they don't like. And you should take that opportunity to do that. To start thinking about, for example, do you want to live in the same place that you work? That's not, I think, something that would have been available as an option to explore until this year. But I think that post-pandemic, that's going to be something you can think about.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Do I want to apply to something that's very remote? Because I'm not sure that it's going to be a requirement for me to live where I work.
Yeah.
Start to think about that. Take the time to figure out how can I maximize the options that are available to me after the pandemic? So take some time to do some real exploration, mm-hmm. take extra classes, even if you've already graduated. Try to figure out, for example, if I'm really having trouble finding a job right now, figure out what you need to do in terms of the money, which might be like gig work or whatever, but mm-hmm. offer your services to somebody for free who you think would be a really good resume builder, right? So start mm-hmm. really thinking about what's going to get me to where I want to go in the future, and start to rethink how you think about jobs and work and that kind of thing. And also rethink what your own values are. But take the lesson from this that you should always be thinking ahead and always have lots of options, because you don't know when things like this are going to happen again. And we tend to overestimate how stable the world is, and we tend to overestimate how much control we have over the future. And hopefully this is a lesson that you will take with you in your life, not to make you fearful, and to make you take less risk, but actually in some ways to make you take more in terms of how flexible you're willing to be in terms of what you think about yourself and what your options are.
That's so interesting. Always be flexible. Make sure that you're keeping the options open.
Yeah.
Just in case something like this ever happens. Thank you so much, Annie. This has been such a pleasure. It's a dream come true to interview you.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. And make sure to check out more content and subscribe to our podcast.